Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Augustine Macellari.
On the show today, Stephanie McDonald, co-founder of architecture practice 6A Architects, which specializes in building galleries worthy of the artworks housed within them. She'll be talking through her latest project, a converted fire station for the South London Gallery.
We'll also be hearing from Richard Reed Perry, the Canadian musician and founding member of Arcade Fire.
And we'll be meeting photographer Harley Weir to discuss her upcoming show at the Brighton Photo Biennial, Homes.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Carlota Rebelo will be here with some of next week's news. And we play some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Hello.
Hello, Og. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Faye?
A pleasure to host the show with you this time. Huh? Favorite time of the week, right?
It sure is. Tell me, what have you been up to this week?
Well, I think the main story of the week that I saw quite a few films, but the main one is Crazy Rich Asians, you know, everybody's talking about. And, you know, I do like a good rom-com, as you probably know. I have to say, it's fantastic. It's and it's quite refreshing. Again, people are talking about diversity. And I can see there's a need for more films like this. And it's quite funny as well.
I was going to say, crucially, is it funny?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things. It is. And Michelle Yeoh is stunning as the mama there of the main character, Henry Golding. She has amazing performance. It's been a while since I saw her on the screen. I think next time, you know, do you remember Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon?
Yeah.
That's an excellent film, right?
Yeah, yeah. Time now to look to the week ahead. And who's joining us this week? None other than Monocle's Carlota Rebelo.
Hello, Carlota. Bem-vinda.
Thank you, Fernando. Nice to be with you guys here at the Monocle Weekly. Let's start off with my first story. We're off to the Maldives.
That's a great place to start.
Remote, tropical, but let's head over to the South Asian nation because today, later today, they're going to be heading to the polls to select the next leader. Now, the current president, Abdullah Yameen, he's seeking his second term, the five-year term. He's from the PPM, the Progressive Party of the Maldives, and the main opposition is a coalition of the Maldivian Democratic Party against him. But in the lead up to this election, since February, there's been such political turmoil in the country. Now, the president passed this state of emergency law just so he could veto actions by the Supreme Court in order to keep his opponents in jail. Because the state of emergency is imposed, he doesn't need a quorum in the parliament in order to pass laws. And he has basically passed a law that all the international observers are saying that it means they won't be able to see the individual ballots. So there's all this huge risk of fraud happening on the vote today.
And Carlota, I have a question about the Maldives. Isn't it one of the countries that are most affected by climate change as well? I mean, it
yes.
might disappear quite soon, frankly.
So, famously, the former president, the one that Yameen tried to keep in jail in 2009, held a cabinet meeting in scuba gear underwater just to highlight how, you know, the country is in the risk of disappearing because it was in an area that years before was above water and now it was under. But the vote today is going to be quite critical because this president has been seen as opening up to Chinese investment a lot among the criticism, of course, of how good actually it is, if it's a death trap or not. And the critics all say, including domestically and internationally, that this is basically a dispute between either cozying up to China or to India. And this election will be crucial in deciding where the Maldives, which is, you know, such a huge travel foreign paradise, will tip over to which of these two investment fronts.
Trouble in paradise indeed. What else have you got?
Okay, moving from, warm Maldives to Germany. Throughout the week, from the 26th to the 30th, it's the Berlin Art Week, which is underway. It's quite interesting. It replaced what was one of the major European art fairs, the Art Forum Berlin, back in 2012. It's now on its seventh edition. Hundreds of cultural institutions, galleries, artists, and even private collectors are coming together to participate, a bit similar to how we do at Frieze here in London. And there are, similarly to Frieze, several sides to it. There's the Arts Fair, the Berlin Contemporary, and then the Preview Berlin Art Fair. But what's interesting is that throughout the week, there's also loads of exhibitions with some very well-known institutions, cultural institutions in Germany, like the KW Institute for Contemporary Art, the National Gallery, and a bunch of others that I'm not going to do them the disfavor of trying to pronounce because my German is terrible. But it is quite interesting. And also, there's a lot of individual shows that are premiering worldwide in this art fair. So trying to bring back the name that the Art Forum Berlin had made for itself through the years, and then when it shut down and it was replaced by the Berlin Art Week, you see lots of artists and cultural institutions that are established trying to save some exclusives for this week to try and bring back some prestige to the city.
I mean, Frieze, it's coming up as well, isn't it? It's early October in London here. Famously has some kind of crazy blockbuster sculpture at the centre of it. Might be, you know, like a Jeff Koons or some mad performance by one of the many performance artists who do their thing there. What kind of stuff can we expect to see at Berlin Art Week?
At Berlin Art Week, they talk about how visitors can expect large-scale exhibitions without giving much away.
Okay.
They're very secretive, which I kind of like. But famously, they award at midnight on the Friday, the 28th, the award for the Berlin Art Prize. So it's this award that goes towards what has been the highlight of the entire week. But in terms of the individual shows, we have Nicholas Nixon, Lee Bull, and Cecilia Johnson, the three artists premiering their work in individual shows on that Friday too. So it's a bit of the highlight of the week. It will be on the third day throughout the Berlin Art Week, but a lot of people are pointing out as that being the highlight and what they're most eager and looking forward to.
Well, Carlotta, muito obrigado.
In a moment, we'll be hearing from Stephanie McDonald about architecture and art. The South London Gallery, halfway between Peckham and Camberwell in South London, funnily enough, is expanding as of this week. The SLG's contemporary art space is adding an annex converted from a former fire station built in 1867, which will house new gallery spaces, an archive room, a terrace and even a kitchen over four floors.
So how do you go about changing the purpose of a building while retaining character and creating a workable space for some of London's most exciting new artists? Well, you ask Art Gallery Specialist Architects 6A, founded by duo Stephanie McDonald and Tom Emerson. Earlier, Augustine met Stephanie at the South London Gallery.
We started working with South London Gallery 10 years ago, and the first part of our work with them opened in 2010. They originally had a single gallery space, top lit, built in the 1860s, beautiful space, but absolutely nothing around it, tiny spaces for staff and education. And that space had been built originally in the 1860s as part of the Working Men's College, a Working Men's College, who had a gallery space and an archive building. The archive building had been bombed in the Second World War and lost, although there were a couple remaining walls. And it had an incredible kind of hidden constituency and community around it. So there was a lot of people that used to come to their shows. They were very big with the kind of YBAs and breaking new artists, fantastic kind of international art program. The Working Men's College's whole ethos was about being about education to working people. And the gallery has always had that kind of at its core. I think Margot's always had that about bringing really fantastic kind of art program that everyone will come to, but that is very naturally available to the sort of big estates, schools, residential, which in which they're kind of located. So being in Peckham, it's got a lot of housing around it and community. The fire station had fallen into disrepair and been derelict for some time. And the Working Men's College is hidden behind Camberwell College. So until it had the house next to it, it didn't have a presence on the street. Now it's really interesting that that kind of civic infrastructure has come back into use along the road between the two buildings for cultural use. And that's absolutely embedded in the community. So our brief with the fire station was to make a kind of amplification or annex to this building, not a standalone thing. and that holds. And it had a very interesting typology because it was one of the first fire stations built. It was built by an architect called Cressy, and he built 26 in very close timing. This one was 1867, and it came about through the forming of the Metropolitan Fire Brigade after a sort of really devastating fire in Tooley Street, where fire brigades used to be private and kind of belong to insurance companies or private, and they were much more kind of scattered. And then they actually decided we need to make a kind of infrastructure, and this is a civic need. So the fire station as a building was just sort of exploring what it would be, what its typology was. And it was like a large house, because before shift systems were introduced, the firemen used to live with their families at the fire station. So that building actually originally had two working rooms on the ground floor, the engine room, a hallway that went through to stables at the back where the horses were kept, and a work room at the back. And then it had an external metal staircase at the back that went up to the family quarters. It became obsolete quite quickly. In the 1920s, moved to kind of engines, and then we didn't need horses anymore and it was no longer big enough. And then it got gradually changed. In the 1930s, it became Kennedy's Sausage Factory, and it was that for quite a long time until that closed down in the 80s, and then I think was sold in 2007, and it's been derelict since then. So there's something lovely about just returning that building intact to the street. It's a really fantastic bit of civic infrastructure.
I'd like to come back to some of the peculiarities of that building, particularly in a sec. But first, I wanted to ask a little bit about 6A's sort of history of working as a practice. You do a lot of work with galleries and with artists who work on artist studios. And I wanted to ask how, you know, that came to pass, whether that was a conscious decision on the part of yourselves or whether that just sort of fell into place and came to be a mode of working that you adopted.
I think that we share values, actually. That's really important. And it's, I think it's just in our natural DNA, in a way. I was at art school before architecture. Tom and I met at the Royal College of Art. It's a really important part of our world, of a way of looking at things and seeing things differently. We naturally go to shows. We know people through college and through friends, and that just grows. And so I think, you know, a lot of our work is word of mouth, and we have a very shared values, but shared interests. We learn from our clients as much as, you know, they get from us, I think. So that's, I think it's a two, you know, it's a discourse or a dialogue, and that's what makes it interesting. And I think, you know, our knowledge has developed about how an artist, we can sort of ask people and friends, we do, you know, as we're doing things, well, would you work, how do you work on this ground? It's interesting seeing how artists are as literate and knowledgeable about building space, even if sometimes they're responding very intuitively. They will respond to an authentic space. They understand the fabric that you're building with. So that's a live conversation as we work with them. That's really exciting. So I think that's probably why. And as you do more, I think you develop experience and new explorations. And I think when you're doing galleries, yeah, most of our work, even if it's retail or even if it's kind of college work, actually it's come out of links generally to Raven Row or to Jürgen's studio, or really particular pieces of work that people have seen and then want to. Sadie's been a long-term collaborator, Sadie Coles. Alex Sainsbury at Raven Row, we're working with Milton Keynes Gallery, we worked with V&A. So I think it's a natural alignment, really, more than a decision to try and do that. I think that would feel quite odd. We're not very good at doing that. We sort of do things quite intuitively, maybe.
You mentioned the Jürgen Teller's studio, which was nominated for the Sterling Prize last year, now, and was a really remarkable piece of sort of work, incredible space. Are there qualities that a gallery space requires, comes to manifest, a slightly chameleonic quality? The South London Gallery's main space is kind of remarkable because it undergoes so many like incredible permutations with different exhibitions. You had Thomas Hirschhorn, who kind of constructed a whole ruin in here, and the art bin, and all of these kind of remarkable things. Is that something that, again, that you kind of have come to react to intuitively, or is it a kind of conscious part of the process of engaging with a brief and coming up with your sort of designs?
No, I mean, it's really conscious. You have to be really aware of what you're doing. And I think we do reduce the kind of visual dimension in a gallery a lot. You really sort of reduce that down to make sure that the art is the foreground always. but that you have a kind of an authentic materiality for an artist to work with. And I think that's the really critical thing. And then there's a lot of kind of paraphernalia and technical stuff. You know, there's aircon or there's fire alarms, all those kind of things, switches, that kind of thing you just need to be really, really attentive to and make sure that those are sort of suppressed visually. They're there and they're things, but you think about them and you make sure that you've got clear wall space and the light's really good. And, you know, somewhere like, and it's different depending on the artist or depending on the gallery, you know, on how much flexibility you need. So someone like Jürgen, that's all in situ concrete and integral colour block work called Linocyte. And that has side light and top light to every gallery. But the beams, the in-situ beams, are like super deep. They're kind of about 600 deep by about 100 mil wide. So very narrow, very deep. And they just filter the light, make it incredibly soft. And Jürgen will use any part of that building, inside or outside, as a backdrop to a shoot. That's really nice. And I think that that's just because everything is what it is. You can, it's quite direct materially. So he can work with that. He doesn't need to sort of cover things or change it.
So then to come back to the fire station, as you kind of mentioned, this building has an incredible history. Not only is it sort of the oldest in London, it could even be the oldest in the UK. So it's kind of perhaps. Yeah. When you're working with a building that has so much kind of integral heritage, how do you come to see your role in repurposing the space?
I think we start any project, whether it's an existing building, one that's super heritage or a new site, with kind of looking at what you've got to work with there, what's really amazing about it, kind of almost like a survey without any judgment to begin with, what's working here and what's good. And that building wasn't really an exception. It's got a fantastic facade. It's 100 years of patina on these old gaunt bricks. You know, you would never clean that back, but you can replace the light in the, and make that very beautiful and sharp and original. But we're working with a gallery. So then we want to make something that's quite luminous and gives them great exhibition spaces and is welcoming. So I would say it's a sort of almost a radical conservation with a building like that, which is about, absolutely about working with its history, but making that live, making that absolute, you know, current, not overwriting it ever, just bringing it back into use, I think, bringing the history back into play. There's a lot of details there that are talking to the Victorian details of the building. We've brought in a completely new staircase, but it could be sort of like a fire escape. It's really carefully silenced to be able to be a gallery. You don't want to be clanging up and down that. You know, an artist can work with it. It's actually a space in itself. It's big enough to do that. So that's a different scale from what was ever in there before. It's released the building and unlocked it and opened it up inside. And yet you've got the original flooring that was sluiced down for horses to go through. You've got all sorts of original pieces in there, so it feels very connected to its past. But you couldn't leave it as this uninsulated building that the gallery would just have to keep, you know, kind of hemorrhaging money on to heat and use, and their staff would be cold in there. So there's other parts that are, like, thickly insulated, or the external walls and the gallery spaces are just lined. But things like where there is aircon, because it's on a red roof, it's a light kind of air cleansing, you know, recirculation of heat. That's just cuts very simply into the floorboards. The floorboards are all kept, and where we had to patch in because it had been derelict for a long time, we've used reclaimed boards from a place nearby. You know, so that's, you wouldn't know the difference between the two. But I think those things, you know, some things have got 100 years and you can feel it is there, and other things have taken it into now. But then they're working together. It's never about, I think there should be a kind of ambiguity about what was here first.
Steffi McDonald there of 6A Architects is speaking to Augustine. Do head down to the South London Gallery to check out their work and the art on show. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly here on Monaco 24.
Time for some new music. We'll be hearing from Arcade Fire's Richard Reed Parry in a moment. This is from his new album, Quiet River of Dust, Volume 1. This is Song of Wood.
Take me through the shadows.
Canadian musician Richard Reed Perry is 1/6 of stadium-filling indie rockers Arcade Fire. But when he's not helping create pop anthems, he makes his own music too. As well as a diverse solo back catalogue, you can hear his contributions on songs from bands such as The National and Sufjan Stevens.
His latest record is Quiet River of Dust, Volume 1. And earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to him from LA, where Arcade Fire were on tour.
The title Quiet River of Dust for me means a lot of different things and refers to a lot of different things. It's kind of, it speaks to family and it speaks to tradition and it speaks to death and it speaks to life and it speaks to generations passing. And, you know, this kind of basic idea, this cyclical idea of life and of ashes to ashes, dust to dust kind of thing. I had this very distinct mental image that came to me as I started writing a lot of the songs, actually, of like a sea burial and someone's ashes being thrown out into the sea and then that water from the sea getting evaporated up into the clouds and then raining down onto the land, and from the land grows a tree and then the tree reaches the end of its life and falls over and dies and rots back into the land and flows down into the sea, and this kind of thing, this kind of eternal cyclical cycles of nature, the cycles of humans. And then there's also a reference for me to an actual physical river in Japan, which is also a mythical, metaphysical river called the River of Death, which is a place, it's like a pre-Buddhist mythological river where the spirits of children who died before their parents would go to wait. It was kind of the river where they'd cross over to the other side, but they'd have to go and await judgment. And there's all sorts of myths connected with it. Yeah, so that exists as a mythological place, but there's also a physical place in Japan that I have been, that I went to accidentally, called the River of Death, which is where parents who have lost children will go and they'll grieve and they'll mourn and they'll offer prayers and send wishes and try to, you know, send a message or a thought across the Great Divide, as it were.
As you were mentioning, you took inspiration from being in Japan for this record. Were there any other locations where you were writing that were kind of informing the sound?
Yeah, sort of all over the place, really. I travel such a lot. And I would say multiple spots in the UK and, yeah, kind of like a rural Scotland near the Hebrides and Wales where I have family. And then my home in Montreal, and then I spend time across the border from Montreal in Vermont a lot out in the woods. And then, yeah, a couple of these really magical trips to Japan. I would say all of the above, yeah.
You're on tour at the moment with Arcade Fire. You're in LA playing shows. I mean, when I listened to your record, I wasn't super familiar with your quite long back catalogue, and the first thing I thought was, oh, this is very different to some of the Arcade Fire stuff. I mean, I know it's a no-brainer, but is it funny to you that when you're in a band of that size, and I think you have to understand that Arcade Fire are a huge band, they're top-tier attractions kind of thing, is it funny to you that people expect the component parts, such as yourself, to make a record that would just sound exactly like an Arcade Fire record? I mean, why does it surprise people that the individuals in the band have their own individual path and their own sort of individual sound?
I can't really say why it surprises people, but for musicians and musician folk, it's just natural to follow the stream of whatever it is that you're interested in or wherever the work that you do is bringing you at that time. And that's just what musicians and artists do, I think, by instinct, by nature. But I think non-musician types or non-artist types maybe have a bit of a different process or thread that governs their life. And so for a musician to veer left or go out on a limb or explore something totally different than what they were doing is totally natural for any musician and any artist. And in fact, it's quite a necessity, I think, for most people I know, most musicians I know, or songwriters or any type of creatives, really, aren't really satisfied. Like, it doesn't really do it for them to just do the same thing over and over again. That's not how we are, I think, as people. And so doing something different, exploring a specific aesthetic or a specific sound world or a different way of writing, or, you know, just taking different approaches is quite a natural necessity. And then that just becomes what you do. You know, if you spend your year exploring a different sound world or a different set of influences, or just trying to accomplish something that you wish to surprise you, you know, you want to discover something new, you want to surprise yourself musically, and then you spend a year doing that, and well, you've made it something that's quite different than what people have previously known you for. And I think that the thing is that when a band gets really famous, or when an artist or a singer gets really famous for doing one thing, there's some kind of, I hesitate to use the word branding, but there's some kind of cultural branding that takes place. People that really attach themselves to a specific idea of, oh, this is what this person does, therefore this is what this person is. And I think it's much more fluid than that for any artist and any musician. It's not actually what you are. It's just something that you were exploring, and something that you needed to say at that time. And once you've said something, you don't really need to say it again. Or maybe you do. Some people do spend their life trying to write the same song over and over again, and that's great also. And usually you're not able to achieve writing the same song over and over again, even if you try. So,
you're certainly, I think no one could accuse you of resting on laurels with this record. Some of the tunes, there's one which I really like called I Was in the World, Was the World in Me? I think it's about 9 minutes and it goes through about 5 different movements. When you're making songs like that, well, can I also say, when it starts, it actually sounds a hell of a lot like The Chain by Fleetwood Mac. It goes in some very strange directions. It goes into, obviously, heaps of melody and harmony and then noise as well. Are you trying to build something fairly grand and symphonic there, or are you trying to build something very freeing and natural and kind of spontaneous?
I would veer towards saying the latter rather than the former, but I was trying to delve deeply into 2 different perspectives on the same subject, I guess, or 2 different versions of the same moment, if you will, which for me, that song is really about like being out in nature and having a kind of nature triggered experience of utter bliss and kind of transcendence and feeling like you're really at one with the world. And then within that moment, this kind of terrifying abyss opening up where you realize that, oh, I really am at one with the world, feeling like I'm in the middle of nature and I'm connected to it and it's connected to me. Isn't that beautiful? And then also, oh my God, we're actually made of the same thing and my body is actually going to fall apart and become the fodder from which trees will grow. And so that song veering from this kind of more folky song to this kind of gigantic explosion of sonic beauty and terror is trying to capture that moment, or both of those moments, you know, both of those perspectives, just like having this total bliss out and then peering or rather leaping straight into the abyss.
You're very succinct in putting these really huge sort of spiraling ideas. And I know that people also read far, far too much sometimes into maybe the thinking process behind songs. But it's sort of like articulating the story of what might be going in the song. Is it something you take pleasure in? Or when a journalist like me asks about it, you're like, oh my God, how do I answer this? Like, how do you see that sort of describing a song in words? Is that something you enjoy and something that you sort of find new meanings to your own songs in, maybe?
Yeah, I actually do enjoy it because I'm actually not someone who's initially lyrically driven. I'll usually fairly often get an idea of what I think the song is about or supposed to be about, or at least a starting point for what it's about when I catch the initial musical idea. But I'm not a Leonard Cohen at all. I don't sit around writing these words that are immaculately worked out and then try and set them to music. And there's writers who do that who are just like incredible, and I have utter respect and awe for such writers, but I am not one of those writers. I need to, this kind of music comes first for me, and then I try and catch a scent of what the song could be about. It usually suggests itself pretty early on in the process, but then it can be ages before I can get the actual words. And I'll usually sing phonetically and I'll work it out musically way before there's any words. Occasionally that is different, and occasionally the words happen right away, but that's so rare for me. But so I have this long convoluted process of I'll sing something phonetically and kind of hear the kind of vowel sounds you could say like in a line before I know what the words are. And then it's this kind of labyrinthine jigsaw puzzle of trying to make the vowel sounds that I heard initially be actual words. It's like, okay, what words sound like those sounds that I was making, and then can make sense and then speak to the thing that I think I want the song to be about. And it's very, very convoluted kind of reverse jigsaw puzzle, but it inevitably works out. And sometimes, like that song, I Was in the World, a good friend of mine who's a writer who lives in Wales also helped me co-write the lyrics for that song. Sometimes I'll reach out and my partner Laurel will help me write a lyric, or, you know, I'll get 70% of the way there and then just feel stuck and we'll just reach out, because lyrics are just not the first thing to my mind, nor the thing that I'm aching to spend time working on.
And volume two, I don't know whether it's just literally two works separately or two halves of the same thing. That's coming in spring. I saw something about it coming on the spring equinox. Is that something relevant, the date, or just something that you thought was fun to incorporate?
No, it's very relevant, I think, because this volume one comes out on the autumnal equinox, and then volume two is the second half of this record. It's a two-part record. It was one giant world of songs that got divided down the middle. To me, the kind of subject matter and the song world and the things that have influenced it, the kind of natural world element of it, to have the first album come out as the year winds down and begins to die, and then have the second album come out as the year cranks up and the next year starts to be reborn again, is very important. It's something I grew up with. Both my parents were folk musicians and folklorists, and kind of, you know, speaking of the UK and tradition and things, like my parents were both Morris dancers, and so I was raised like getting up at 5 a.m. on May Day morning to go down to the park and hang out with the Morris dancers while they welcomed in the sun and welcomed in the spring, and I kind of grew up singing loads of songs about those things. So for me, it's really close to home and just kind of the way things are done. You tie things to the turning of the year.
There's a really surprising to people in the UK, I think, but I have no idea why I was researching this once, but there's a pretty massive amount of Morris dancers in the US. I don't know whether it's a Canadian thing as well, but there's like, yep, Morris dancing teams. Like,
well, oh, I know. I grew up around them.
Indeed. I mean, I guess it makes sense. I just think it's something that we think of like very innately as British or very oldie worldy.
Right. I mean, there's so many descendants of, I think, in North America, and there's something, you know, that was going on for quite a long time. And I think something about it just catches people and resonates for a certain type of person with a certain sensibility. So yeah, like loads of my childhood was spent in the summers, was being carted around to Morris Ales, as they would call them. They'd have like a weekend out where loads of teams would descend on the city and they'd go and dance in parks and out in the streets. And it was just a big old celebration of dancing and people drinking beer and having a good old time, I guess.
Do you have a favorite Morris move? Are you a bell man, a stick man? What's your thing?
All of the above, and there were sword teams as well in my neighborhood. Both my parents each were on two different teams over the course of their lives, and my mom's, they both started on the same team in Toronto that was called Green Fiddle Morris, and then that Green Fiddle got two different splinter factions off, and there became a men's team and a women's team. There was the Toronto Morris Men and the Bells of York. So my mom joined the Bells of York, which was a clog team, which is quite beautiful. And my dad's team was more of a sticks and handkerchiefs team.
This is getting deep into Morris knowledge that
it goes quite deep for me. I can speak for eternity on the subject. It was really a giant part of my childhood.
And then just one last thought. Arcade Fire, you're known for coming out with different looks, different kind of outfits and stuff. Are you ever going to incorporate a Morris element to Arcade Fire? I think it's surely time.
I can't speak to that. But perhaps it's more likely to turn up in my solo stuff, I must say, than with Arcade Fire.
Richard Reed Parry there, speaking to Tom Hall. And Richard's album, Quiet River of Dust, Volume 1, is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Photographer Harley Weir's work has appeared in the pages of publications such as Another magazine, Vogue, ID, and more. And her personal artistic projects focus on issues ranging from sex and gender to our sense of place.
It's the latter that informs her new show at Fabrica in Brighton, UK, as part of the Brighton Photo Biennial. Holmes collects photos from Weir's visit to the jungle refugee camp in Calais in 2016, the site that became a symbol of Western Europe's disconnect from the plight of displaced people seeking asylum from conflict. Harley Weir joins us now to talk about Holmes and her other work. Welcome, Harley, to the Monocle Weekly. First, I'd quite like to know a little bit about your background, because I know that you studied fine art and came to photography that way.
Yeah, so I studied fine art at St Martin's, but it actually started much earlier than that with disposable cameras that my mum used to give me, I think, on school trips. And I just started really getting into that. And then when I got a little bit older, I would paint from the photos I'd taken. But then in the end, I realised that I was actually a lot better at just taking the pictures than painting. So it kind of went there very quickly.
When you see yourself, you know, as a photographer, I mean, from a young age, when you were studying at university, were you thinking that you were going to do fashion or more something like your project here home at Calais, something a bit more?
I mean, fashion was never... I always liked clothes that were an item of art. I did actually, quite young, start collecting pieces from Issey Miyake and Jean-Paul Gaultier. Really small things on eBay where I used to get really good deals. I would scan eBay forever looking for clothes that had images of the body on them, which both brands kind of have something of. And so I did appreciate fashion, but I definitely wasn't... I never wanted to be a fashion photographer. I wanted to be an artist, but art school made me lose my grounding on that one. I got a bit confused when I went to art school, I think.
It's a disorienting place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can really put you off.
It really put me off. It's such a shame, but it did.
I'm quite interested in how, you know, with this kind of background in art and this more experimental and kind of conceptually rigorous visual language that you have behind you, how you kind of fit into the editorial fashion world now, whether you see that place for that kind of photography as kind of having come from, you know, a slightly more open set of conceptual boundaries that the fashion world has today.
That part at the end that you said there is definitely what drew me in, you know, the creative freedom. Also, I suppose a lot of the reason I went into fashion was because there's not really any money in not many other forms of photography, so it certainly was more of like a commercial decision. And when I was younger, you know, someone asked me to do a fashion shoot and I was like, oh cool, that is great, and I was really excited about that. I didn't realize maybe what the industry was actually like, and I'm definitely slowly finding it harder to continue in that world.
Which perhaps shouldn't be a problem as well. Because
it's not a problem.
Let's talk a little bit more about this. So you've been to Calais, you stay for how long did you stay?
So in probably about 2012, I visited, this is a quite long story, but this is why I made the book, so I just tell you. In 2012, I went actually on a fashion shoot, which I think fashion really was a great window to travel through, and I'm really thankful to that part of it. But anyway, so I travelled to Israel to do a shoot there, and I decided to book a few extra days to travel around and visit Jerusalem. I'd heard about the wall that segregates the country, and I was quite confused about that. And so I went to visit that. That confusion led to a project called Boundaries, where I visited borders. And so I went back to Israel a few times and I photographed both sides in Palestine and the other side of the wall, pretty much. And then I came back, I did a few other ones. I went to Abkhazia and Georgia, which is another very like volatile border situation. And then I tried to do one other one in Russia and North Korea, which was totally a failure. I didn't get anywhere near the border, but fashion actually kind of made me feel like I didn't, since I'd been working in fashion for so long, I was like, my voice isn't relevant. I don't feel like I have a right to talk about these topics. I was very shy that I'd done the projects even. I was almost embarrassed. I was like, oh gosh. I remember speaking about it with someone and they were like, look, that's not really the kind of thing you should be doing. You should keep your mouth shut and stay, you know, in fashion stuff. It's not really your place to talk about those kind of issues. So I just sort of thought, yeah, lost my confidence in the project and sort of like let it die, I suppose. Always being interested in borders, and things really blew up, I suppose, in 2015. Like, you couldn't really avoid the topic. Everyone was having to look at this, look at the world and see what was going on. Like I did that day when I saw the wall and I was like, what the fuck is going on? I heard about Calais and that was something that felt a lot closer to home. This is obviously people that are trying to get to the UK. And I drove past there once on a holiday and I saw there just happened to be a riot, which apparently was every day. And it really shook me what I saw. There was just clouds of smoke. There was guys, refugees, migrants, people just running like everywhere. It was very, very shocking. And when I heard that it was going to be destroyed, I just felt like I really needed to visit the place to understand it better and see what was going on. So I went to visit it. I didn't intend to make a book or anything like that. I just went with my cameras and things. I photographed what I saw and I was quite surprised at what I saw, really. I was really scared to go, actually, but what I saw was something really positive. Everyone there was so kind to me, really amazing people that I met when I was there. I didn't want to take photos of anyone, so I took photos of the homes, the people that had introduced me, gave me a tea, gave me a coffee. I took a picture of their home, you know, because people were quite proud to show me. They were like, come to my tent, show this, like, show that. And I was really impressed, I suppose, by the ingenuity and just like the humanity you could see in the places they were staying and like the churches they'd built, the mosques they'd built. I just thought it was really, really powerful to see that side of this crisis.
It's really interesting that you say that you kind of didn't want to take photos of people. And I guess that because I was reading around and you've spoken in the past about consent and about ownership of images and how, you know, maybe photographers might kind of assume that because they're the ones who've taken a picture, they're the ones who have all the kind of metaphysical property rights to it.
Exactly. I find it very weird, even with selling prints is something that I've only just started now. And I just really find it bizarre to be like, well, I'm going to be selling a print of this person's nipple. That's not my nipple. This is, you know, this is like some guy's nipple and someone's asking to spend a fair amount of money on it. 50% belongs to me. And I feel like a photo also belongs to someone else. And I do think people forget. And I think that's where a lot of the problems with the Me Too situation, like people just didn't, I don't think photographers understood their place as a viewer rather than, obviously lots of people create images and that's very different. But a lot of reportage, most of fashion is really, really a collaboration with other people. And just any photo that includes another person, I think you really need to think about who is in that photo and what's right to do with that image.
I mean, I suppose it depends a lot on the kind of ultimate purpose of the photo. If someone's taking pictures to be published in a newspaper to inform a public about ongoing trouble. I did want to ask, I mean, you've semi-answered that, but I did want to ask kind of how these ideas related back to the sort of approach and attitude you brought to the project in the jungle, you know, and what the kind of residual feelings you had around the kind of domestic environments that these people had created, but like, but these people's stories as well that you were kind of transmitting were.
I just really felt like it wasn't my place to be taking pictures of people there. It just felt like you could see something of them in that without being too much a voyeur, disturbing their home, which is what it was, you know, at the time. I'm good friends with a couple of people that I met there still. And I know that when it got shut down, like, they obviously didn't want to be there, but they also cried because, you know, they'd lived there. There was a home too. So I think it was also nice to document something that these people had made.
That's one thing that I noticed in the pictures. There's a lot of kind of respect towards these people. I really love that picture of the brown pill on top of a kind of a star-printed duvet or something. That's a very touching picture, if you can describe it to the listeners.
I think the one you're talking about is a crumpled rug that's on the floor in one of the tents. I think a lot of, I guess, most of it came from donations and found things, but you can see someone's presence in those images, and I think that's what's kind of really important to be able to see, just see something. There's another picture where there are all these toothbrushes lined up on a big piece of tarpaulin tent, and I just think it's nice to really realise what these people were actually up to. Day in, day out, they were actually like also getting on with life and trying to make the best out of what they had, which is not very much.
You mentioned that you kind of remained friends with some of the people you met during that time. Obviously, it's now a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I wondered sort of how your experiences and your experiences of that project have kind of come to inform, you know, your work since.
Well, I certainly can't stop realizing how lucky I am. That's certainly a massive takeaway. There was a moment at the end, the very end of the project, and it was after the whole place had been bulldozed, and the people that lived there were not very happy about their place being bulldozed, and they wanted to have, like, you know, they wanted to be in charge of that. So that people were making fires and they were burning their own places before people could destroy them. And so there was a lot of fires breaking out, and the sun was going down, and I stayed a little bit too long. It got completely dark, and I called the taxi company and asked them if they would come and pick me up, but they just didn't. And my phone was at 1%. And this chap came over and was like, "Can you help me?" And I just looked at him, and I thought he was an aid worker because he looked pretty smart and he was a lot bit older. And I was like, "Look, what can I do for you?" And he was like, "I just walked from Afghanistan for 3 months, and I thought there'd be like refugee here. And I went inside, and they told me I'm too old to get any help, any aid from now." And I was like, "I didn't know how to help him. I'm really sorry. I don't know what I can do, but maybe you could come back here tomorrow and ask again, and hopefully they could help you." And then he just turned around and he literally burst into tears, and I watched him walk away, like crying his eyes out. And it was so sad. And so I broke down as well and started crying on the side of the road. And within 1 minute, two girls drove by and picked me up and drove me to the Eurostar. And I was just like, yeah, a white girl sits and cries on the side of the street, and someone will pick her up and take her where she needs to go, and that's that. And I was like, no one's going to pick up that guy and take him where he needs to go. And that's kind of the biggest thing that I took from that project, acknowledging we as very privileged people need to be making an effort to help anyone that isn't, basically.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that perhaps not only the UK but Europe should should look into it. And that's, you know, precisely where you're going to be exhibiting your pictures at the Brighton Photo Biennale. And one of the you know, the main topic is like a new Europe as well. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I'm really glad to be a part of it. I think it's a really important topic. And I think a lot of people feel like these issues, I guess they sort of went, they got drained from the press a little bit, and people kind of thought they went away. And I think it's really important to be reminded that this is like probably one of the biggest issues we're facing. I think it's really important that the Brighton has like taken charge of that topic.
You've been inspired by your experiences in some places, and a lot of them are wrapped in trauma and conflict and sort of unpleasantness, for want of a better word. How do you continue to find these sort of incidents of beauty?
For me, that is really important, because I think people need to see a beauty to know that it's worthwhile to keep going, you know? I think the reason the images in Homes, for example, do look so beautiful is because I saw that beauty in those people and I wanted to show it to people. And I think in a lot of reportage images, which is exactly what they ought to be doing, it is very raw and it looks absolutely awful, but there's just something that people don't get to see, which I think is a real shame, because not every, you know, person in the refugee camp wants to have like a desaturated image of themselves crying at their dead child. Like, there's also another side of that person that needs to be seen, and I think it's completely necessary to have that, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be there, it's 100% needs to be there, but I think there's also other sides of things like that people shouldn't kind of be like, oh well, you made it look nice, so that's wrong. It's like, actually, life is beautiful no matter where the fuck you are, and you need to be able to see those images also. And so, like, in the beginning when people kind of told me you shouldn't be taking images like this, it's, you know, it's disrespectful to have a huge issue like that and have it be in some way beautiful, I think that's also very small-minded. So I think it's just about having different kinds of images and not having just this specific type of image that makes you feel very distant and like you can't kind of like approach that person. And that's another reason why, for example, my friend who I still speak to who lives in France is having a really hard time. Like, people are like afraid of him. No one gets to know that he's also beautiful.
And Holly, of course, just for our listeners to know, I mean, Home is being published for the second time.
It's a second edition,
and, you know, where can someone, you know, get hold of a copy?
You can buy it online, actually, through Loose Joints, which is a publishing company in the UK, and they will send it anywhere.
And Homes by Harley Weir is at the Fabrica Gallery, part of the Brighton Photo Biennial. That runs from this week until the end of November. Do go and check out some of the other shows if you can. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
That's all for edition 481 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and Augustine Macellari, and our studio managers were Kenneth Collett and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Augustine Macellari. Goodbye!